On the Islamic calendar, we are in the month of Ramadan, which began on Monday and ends a little more than 3 weeks from now on April 9th. One of the five pillars of Islam is fasting during the entire month of Ramadan from sunrise to sunset for all healthy adults. The other four pillars are making a profession of faith, praying five times a day, giving to charity, and at least once in your life, if you're able, making a pilgrimage to Mecca. Although all five pillars are important, the spiritual practice of fasting during Ramadan, and I think this isn't as obvious to folks if you don't know a lot of folks who are Muslim, is that the spiritual practice of fasting during Ramadan is particularly significant to many Muslims. About 80% of Muslims, 8 in 10, fast during Ramadan. In contrast, only about half as many Muslims actually pray five times a day, so about 43%, or about half as many Muslims, again, actually attend mosque weekly, only about 43%. So Ramadan, it's really a big deal. And the Ramadan fast itself is quite rigorous. It requires refraining not only from eating food, but also from drinking liquids, from smoking, from sex, even from anger. But more important, really, than what you don't do, the spiritual practice of Ramadan is about refocusing all of that freed up time and energy for prayer, for reflection, for helping those in need, and for spending time in community. For you Muslims who are both members of this congregation, and for all others who are observant, Ramadan Mubarak, may you have a blessed Ramadan. And for anyone who has friends and families and family members or colleagues who are observing Ramadan, may we be sensitive and compassionate and supportive to those who are fasting and may need a little extra loving kindness this month. This Ramadan, I'm acutely aware as well that 99% of the Gaza Strip is Muslim. And it's one thing for adults to freely choose to fast and another thing entirely to be starved, as the case for too many Palestinians today. This devastating photo, and all too common, is of a Palestinian family in central Gaza preparing, you know, surrounded by rubble, preparing to celebrate the iftar meal to break their fast on the first day of Ramadan. This photo is from just a few days ago. I continue to pray for both a permanent ceasefire and for a safe return of the hostages. And I continue to look for those individuals and groups who are committed to co-creating a future in which both Israeli and Palestinian lives matter. In preparation for Ramadan and for this sermon on Islam, I've been reading a book titled 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. It's by Haroon Mogul, an academic turned public intellectual. It's published by our own Beacon Press, which is owned by the Unitarian Universalist Association. The title refers to the approximately 1.9 billion Muslims in the world today, which I think can fairly round up to 2 billion, right, with the title. To give you some points of reference, 2 billion Muslims represents about 25% of the world's population, and that makes Islam the world's second largest religion. Looking ahead, current projections has Islam on track to be the world's largest religion around 2070. The primary factor is that many countries in which that have a large percentage of Muslim populations are expected to grow at about twice as fast as the overall global population. Here in the U.S., Muslims are only about 1% of the population, but there has been a significant increase over the past few decades. Again, to give you just a few points of reference, if we turn the clock back 50 years to 1967, there were less than 250,000 Muslims here in the U.S. If we fast forward today, there are about 3 billion. So that's a 12-fold increase over the past five decades. Again, if you go back to 1967, there were about 200 mosques in the U.S. Now there are about 2,000. So again, that's a tenfold increase over the past five decades. To give you a little bit more of a comparative perspective, I'm going to show you three sets of paired graphs. These are from the Pew Templeton Foundation's Global Religious Futures Project. You can Google that if you're interested in more similar data. So the first of these three pairs is Islam population by country. I'm going to show you 2020, and then we're going to switch to 2050. And there's a few things to notice here. The first is, in both 2020 and 2050, way more in like Africa and Asia, right? So you can see just a little tiny dot in North America. But if I toggle between 2020 and 2050, you're going to see the circle. Do you see them all slightly growing? Like they're growing everywhere, including in the U.S. The U.S. is small, but again, doubling from 1% to 2%. The second pair is of all the world religions worldwide, again, from 2020, and then I'm going to show you 2050. So if we look at the big three, Christianity is in red. And so you can see, you know, about, 2 billion Christians, and toggle to 2050, you know, Christianity is growing. But if you look at the Islam, Muslims in green, do you see how Christianity is growing, but Islam is growing a lot faster? And then if we look at Hinduism, again, growing as well. I could go through the others. I guess specifically, and I've gone into this in such great depth, if it gives you any sense of some of how Israelis, I think, unfortunately, Netanyahu, of course, terrible, stipulated, but you can see how it is Israel to Palestine is, of course, David and Goliath, but many Jews also in the wake of the Holocaust, if you can see, you know, there are only 16 million Jews in the world. And that's the sort of larger figure that we're dealing with this complicated geopolitical situation. Finally, I want to toggle between just here. So this is the U.S. instead of worldwide, again, from 2020 to 2050. You can see here in the U.S., Christianity is dropping. You can see that Muslims are doubling in size, but still, only about 8 million. And then Hindus, you can see, are growing, but are still quite small. So it's just a little bit of data to kind of contextualize all of this. But I want to hasten to add probably an even more important point, and that's to emphasize the diversity of the world's 1.9 billion Muslims. Most you use, I think, are aware that most Muslims are neither terrorists nor terrorist sympathizers, but rejecting Islamophobic caricatures is insufficient for appreciating the truly diverse nature of contemporary Islam. Although many people's strongest associations with Islam is Arabic-speaking person from the Middle East, only 20% of Muslims are Arab. Let me say that again. Only 20% of Muslims are Arab. And if you kind of think 80% of Muslims are Arab, that would be understandable, but it would be because of the media caricatures about Islam. The countries with the largest Muslim populations, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Nigeria, those are all democracies, disproving the myth that Islam is incompatible with democracy. In the words of a religion professor from American University nearby in DC, Saudi Arabia has only the 16th largest Muslim population, behind countries like Uzbekistan, Ethiopia, Turkey, Iran, all have larger Muslim populations than Saudi Arabia. For what it's worth, Saudi Arabia's Muslim population is roughly equivalent to China's Muslim population. All of this should make us reconsider not only how we perceive Islam, but also the locus of its power and influence. While the Saudi government routinely tries to cast itself as the protector and defender of the faith, they truly represent only a small fraction of the world's Muslims. Close to home, I was pleased to see a few weeks ago that the Frederick County Board of Education voted unanimously to close schools on both Islamic Eid holidays starting in fall 2025. This photo is from that Frederick County Board of Trustees meeting. Eid, spelled E-I-D, is the Arabic word for festival or feast. It refers to the two major Muslim holidays, Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of the month of fasting during Ramadan, and Eid al-Adha, which marks the culmination of the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. These Eids are the two major consensus holidays among the world's Muslims, and only about 70 days apart. In the words of one of the many members of the Muslim community who attended that Frederick County Public School Trustees meeting to advocate for this change, they said, "It is not only important for Muslim students, it is also important for other students to be aware of such significant holidays in our community." Relatedly, I was glad to hear that New York City recently made a significant change just a few months ago to allow mosques to broadcast the Muslim call to prayer both middays on Fridays and also in the evenings during Ramadan without obtaining a permit and regardless of sound restrictions in city neighborhoods. In the words of Mayor Eric Adams, "Today we are cutting the red tape and saying clearly, if you are a mosque, you are free to live your faith in New York City." As someone who grew up Christian in South Carolina, I have always been able to take for granted that my faith would be, you know, represented and respected and officially taken into consideration until I became UU, but that's another sermon. Today, as a Unitarian Universalist minister committed to religious pluralism and multiculturalism, I'm grateful to see a growing awareness and respect for religious diversity, even as there remains such a long way to go. Let me give you just a few more points to consider about factors that shape our collective perceptions of Islam. Even though Muslims, again, make up 25% of the global population, one in four humans alive today are Muslim, and that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, 1% of characters on popular TV shows are Muslim. 1%. The majority of Muslim characters are depicted as adult Middle Eastern or North African men. Again, even though only 20% of Muslims are Middle Eastern, and despite the fact that Muslims are the most racially and ethnically diverse religion in the world. Over 30% of Muslim characters are also, of that 1%, 30% are depicted as perpetrators of violence. And the ratio of male Muslim characters to female ones in this TV show is 174-1. It's heavily, heavily male. And only one, single one, identified as an LGBTQ Muslim. Representation matters. And these biased portrayals of Muslims in media are both perpetuating stereotypes and failing to help us, both Muslim and non-Muslim, to collectively imagine a present-day Islam that is as diverse as it actually is, as well as to imagine a more equal and inclusive future. You know, we need like the Muslim will and grace and, you know, that kind of thing. If we consider print media, academic studies have similarly found the average print article mentioning Muslims or Islam in the U.S. is more negative than 84% of articles in a random sample. That means you'd have to read 6 articles in U.S. newspapers to find even one that is negative as the average article touching on Muslims. The takeaway, again, is that such a systemic negativity bias has both exacerbated current stigmatization of Muslims and undermines our collective attempts to co-create a better, more equitable, and more inclusive future for all. Now, let me also be clear. I am on the side of Muslims that are trying to create a more open-minded, open-hearted, pluralistic version of Islam. That's what I want for all religious traditions. So if you're wondering, am I on the side of Muslims seeking to create a more egalitarian, gender-liberated, LGBTQ-welcoming version of Islam? Of course I am. That's what I want for all religious traditions. And just as I am deeply troubled by the lack of diverse representations of Muslims in the media, as well as a general systemic negativity bias against Islam, I am also equally troubled by the periodic controversies that flare up in academia around whether various forms of art, for example, are blasphemous and offensive to some Muslims. I don't want to get lost in the weeds of specific details, but one reoccurring flashpoint is around images of the Prophet Muhammad. It is definitely true that many Muslims today believe that it is offensive to show images of Muhammad. So on the one hand, I want to be sensitive, I want to be respectful, I want to be not necessarily insulting to any person of faith. On the other hand, in our secular colleges and universities, any individual person's beliefs have to be balanced against the academic freedom to explore any topic in an untrammeled way. Similarly, like public art galleries have to be free to display whatever they want in our free and open society. Now, pedagogically, one option is to offer content warnings to give like text-based alternatives when you're dealing with potentially offensive material, you know, to give alternatives as needed. But if we skip controversial material altogether, we will miss there are also Muslims today who are not offended by pictures of Islam, pictures of Muhammad, or even want to create them themselves. More significantly, we'll miss that historically, Muslims themselves in various parts of the Islamic world have created and enjoyed figural representations of Muhammad. There exist numerous images of Muhammad created by Persian and Turkish artists, in particular from the 13th century all the way to today, many of which were miniatures or illustrations in book manuscripts. In some of them, Muhammad's face is covered by a halo. In others, they show his face. So if we allow only one theologically conservative version of Islam to control and dominate and define the playing field, then both Muslims and non-Muslims will be denied the opportunity to learn about the diverse history of Islam. After all, what is college for if not to experiment with the sacrilegious, with what you've been told is sacrilegious, and having a chance to decide for yourself, do I actually think this is blasphemous or not? And what have different people, or, you know, throughout time thought about that? Here's the way I often frame the situation for my world religion students at Frederick Community College. There has never been one monolithic Islam. There have always been Islams, plural. One can likewise historically trace all the competing Christianities and Hinduisms and Buddhisms and paganisms and more. Having grown up in a theologically conservative Christian congregation, I am intimately familiar with parallel situations in some conservative streams of Christianity who want to impose their understandings of morality on the rest of us. These are challenging waters to navigate, but I'm also acutely aware that one person's blasphemy can be another person's vital expression of art that is seeking to push us and challenge us and provoke us into new ways of thinking and being. And we should no more allow our universities and art galleries and other public spaces to be unduly influenced by fundamentalist Islam than we would allow them to be by fundamentalist Christianity or the fundamentalisms of any of the world's religions. And that brings us back full circle to Harun Magul's book, 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. Caliph is from the Arabic word for successor or deputy or steward, and it has the connotation of successor of the messenger of God, that is Muhammad. Traditionally, the caliph would be the leader of the entire Muslim world, unified under one caliphate. But Magul invites us to consider a different future, not like the Lord of the Rings, one caliph to rule them all. From one geographic center that imposes this monolithic Islam on all. His vision is more akin to a Protestant Reformation, which of course I'm down with, that in which there are as many Islams as there are Muslims, distributed, democratized, diversified. In Magul's word, we must free Islam from the grip of either religionized politics or politicized religion. If you're curious to learn more, one interesting place to start is the study Quran. How many of you have read the Quran? Okay, a few hands here and there. This study Quran is published by HarperCollins. It's like a study Bible, if you're familiar with that. It has both the sacred text as well as annotations underneath to kind of contextualize it, has essays throughout to kind of introduce it, to give you historical and theological context. Two tips for the uninitiated, if you've never read the Quran, it is not chronological. It is actually the surahs, which are the word for chapters. They're just organized from longest to shortest. So that can be like people sometimes start reading it and are really disoriented, which is why a study Quran can help. Also, one of the biggest misunderstandings, the word Allah is not the word for the like Muslim God. Allah is nothing more than the Arabic word for God. If you were a Jewish person in an Arabic country praying, you would say Allah. If you were a Christian living in a Muslim country or in an Arabic speaking country, you would say Allah. It's nothing more than the Arabic word for God. I'll end for now with a parallel note from UU history. Is it good or bad news to move from one caliph to 2 billion caliphs? Some might say it's blasphemous. Others would say it's just choice. Many of you know the word heretic. It's just the Greek word to choose. If someone calls you a heretic, they're just calling you a chooser. You're choosing for yourself instead of allowing someone else to choose for you. So, you know, it could actually be good news, freedom, liberation. So the parallel from UU history is in 1531, our Unitarian forebear, Michael Servetus, published a book with a very subtle subtitle that made it not really clear what he was writing about. It was titled, On the Errors of the Trinity. So, but he wrote this not as bad news. He went back and read the Bible. So think about what's happening in 1531, right? It's not long after 1517, Protestant Reformation. A little bit before that, a dude named Johannes Gutenberg made the movable type printing press, right? So all of a sudden you had copies of the Bible more accessible. So he read it for himself and said, you know what? The word Trinity isn't in there. He wasn't saying you were dumb to believe in the Trinity. He was saying it's optional to believe in the Trinity. That's what he meant by the error of the Trinity. And he published this book saying, this is good news. This doctrine of the Trinity that has been keeping Jews and Christians and Muslims apart and even killing each other, you can believe it if you want, but it's optional. That's the error that he was writing about, thinking that it's core to the faith. Much of what theologically orthodox adherents of any religion claim is essential is actually optional. And the more you dig into the history, you will see how things that people claim have been the same throughout is actually this history of change that has grown, evolved. So there really is original diversity the more you dig into any religious tradition. There are Islams and Christianities and Buddhisms and paganisms and more. So as we hold that in our heart and think about the type of religious adherence we want to try to be promoting as you use in the 21st century, let's rise, embody your spirit in your teal hymnals. We're going to sing this through twice. Hymn 1058, Be Ours a Religion.